shall we? Let's do it. Come on, Doctor Who.
I kind of want to make that into the new theme tune. Let's do it. Come on. It's Doctor Who. Be good.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to episode 71 of On the Timelash. Hello, I'm Ben.
I'm Mark. Hello. And this time we'll be discussing Chris Chibnall's The Power of Three and repairing that up with Robert Mike Stewart's The Seeds of Doom. When I first suggested it, it was a bit like, I don't know, like UNIT maybe? Is that it? And like little pods and boxes. But actually, I think there's some stuff about friendship and nearing the end of a friendship that might be quite interesting to kind of pick up on as we discuss both stories. Human beings as pests as well is another element of both stories.
Also, previously, safe spaces or familiar characters and environments suddenly being like, oh, that's weird. I haven't really seen it like that before. Okay, I get you. Okay, so The Power of Three. It was written by Chris Chibnall. And it was directed by Douglas McKinnon. It was broadcast on the 22nd of September 2012. And it was watched by live 5.4 million, but with consolidated overnights raising to 7.67 million folks watched it. But this is the fun bit. This is the bit we all love. It's the Doctor Who magazine first 5 decades poll. Or, as it's better known, Degsy's Where Did It Come Game? Mark, out of 241, where did The Power of Three...
I know the answer to this.
Yeah. Well, yes, you do. Yes, you do.
So, what I'll do, first of all, I'll read Derek's entry. I think the build-up in The Power of Three is excellent. The slow invasion of the cubes that all do different things works for me. The problem is that the resolution has to be one of the worst in the history of Doctor Who. One for the Sonic, and that's it. Problem solved. What a cop-out. Also, Stephen Burkoff's delivery is bizarre, which doesn't help. We will absolutely come to that as we go on. A good story ruined in the final third. I think it may come close to Dinosaurs on the Spaceship in the Pole, so I'll say 164. I will also say that's 164, because that's the right answer.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. It's 164 because it's after something that we've just recently visited, 163, A Town Called Mercy, and then 165.
Derek had said that he thought it came close to Dinosaurs on the Spaceship in the Pole.
It does. That's in number 157. Ah, okay. So it's not too far away. But yeah, there's weirdly that series is all grouped around the same basic 10 numbers. So
congratulations, Derek. I should say, I did because he texts me after he listened to our Town Called Mercy episode to say, oh, I've got it bang on. I've got the answer bang on. And I said, well, I'll get you a prize. Yeah. So I'm going to grab the prize. Hang on.
Okay.
So I hope you haven't got this, Derek. I'm going to try and post this before the episode goes out so that he hears the episode but then receives the... I don't know. It won't work. But it's Hancock by Freddie Hancock and David Nathan. So it's a biography of Tony Hancock, which I nicked from a pub at the weekend. So congratulations.
Alrighty. Okay. Well, let's... we got listener correspondence.
We do indeed. So, I'll come to JR at the end because he basically answers a question that a lot of people have, or at least suggest it having. Jeff Waddle. So, we always say on this podcast that Jeff is very concise, very just like to the point. He basically encapsulates what we both think about stories, and then he goes off on his next adventure. He's like even more concise than ever. Power of Three. Dash. Good concept, poorly realised, villain wasted. Full stop.
Somebody was in a hurry.
Daniel Holford, the power of three has a great concept, and the first half is probably the most Russell T Davis that the Moffat era goes, and it's certainly not a bad thing. Great setup, great mystery, sadly ruined by the very rushed ending and an odd villain. It all gets solved by the Sonic within 5 seconds, which should never be the case. Make it a two-parter and maybe you have a winner. However, Kate Stewart is fantastic. She is pretty good. This is in the kind of stage where I think with a lot of Stephen Moffat characters, their early episodes are always the best before he kind of forgets how to write them. Mudaba on Twitter. When I first saw it, I didn't think much of it, but it's something I've appreciated more and more over time. The plot is properly rubbish, but it's more than made up for by all the great character stuff. Just a shame it ends on such a screamingly awful line from Amy. That is a pretty bad pun. Gav Wood, there should be more love for the Power of Three. Really entertaining stuff. And that lovely scene between the Doctor and Amy. The first face this face saw. And then there's a little crying face emoji. Just to... Yeah, and then that's all seeds of doom. Now, obviously, people have highlighted the fact that the ending is very rushed. And JR has the answer to that. So there's a reason the ending to The Power of Three ended up the way it did. The actual ending they shot turned out to be unusable. So because the episode was a late edition and was produced very close to broadcast, they were left having to put together whatever kind of ending they could manage from the footage that was available. Personally, I think it works okay. Like many Doctor Who stories, it's really about the journey, not the resolution. And in that sense, it's unusual and fantastic. It might be Chris Chibnall's best story. It might be. What do we think? What do you think, Ben?
So that correspondence section that neatly unpacks where this chat, I presume, is going to go. It's interesting what JR was saying there about the ending. I didn't know any of that, and in actual fact, it would be interesting. I mean, you know, I don't mean know his source. As in, all right, sure you're working, but I couldn't find any real explanations for that.
If you do a bit of rooting, I did a bit of rooting around on Twitter because I remember seeing something a while back about this. Mm-hmm. And again, I won't name names or anything like that, but there was the sense I got from that is it's something to do with, as JR said, the script was a late edition, but then also. They kind of had to cut around a lot of Stephen Berkoff's rather, shall we say, unique performance?
Wait, so when he says it was unusable, is it a technical thing or is it they cast an absolute maniac?
I think they cast an absolute maniac. This is putting what JR said and what I've read mm-hmm. is that it's basically, I read something that said. Whatever the problems with the end of The Power of Three, it's not the fault of Chris Chibnall, the regulars, or the director, Douglas MacKinnon.
Right, it's like, okay.
Well, that narrows it down.
Okay, that's interesting.
Because obviously Douglas MacKinnon comes back plenty of times after that and goes on to direct stuff like Line of Duty, which is, you know, one of the BBC's sort of best loved and most successful TV programmes of the past sort of 10 years. So I'm pretty convinced it's not his fault.
Right. Okay.
Either, you know what I mean.
Okay, that's interesting. Well, yes. So, and I agree with JR. This is a really pleasant journey. I mean, mm-hmm. loads of people die and bad stuff happens, but you know, I mean, it's just like it's really nice watching it unfold. Well, Derek said it as well. And it's kind of weirdly a pleasure to be in Amy and Rory's life, considering they've been with the Doctor and, to be honest, sidelined in the last few episodes. They've got good moments, but this is the first time we get to like sit down with them again properly and have a look at their life and get that weird sense of what it is like not to just be on the TARDIS for your full duration, but that there's this pest that keeps showing up. You know, hoovering you away for, what, a couple of months during a party. You know, and just stuff like the idea of, like, Amy saying, like, we probably have to curtail this. Our friends are going to see us getting older, you know, because their lifetime is infinitely more involved and longer than the small amount of time that he seems to keep dipping them back onto Earth, you know. And yeah, very possibly it is one of my... out with his showrunning tenure, it is, I think, my favourite episode of his. But is that because it harks back to something a bit more familiar? Because it feels like an RTD? And I don't know. I don't necessarily know if it does. But it's weirdly comforting to be back in, like a brightly lit London that in and of itself is not the thing that wants to kill. You know what, like we talked about with say, night terrors, you know, where the whole place is just kind of designed to look like a, you know, like just an atmospheric, oppressive area, where it's just nice to be back at, like, a normal thing with, like, a familiar threat. So I don't know. Something that could conceivably be seen as a weakness, i.e. derivative. It's deliberately like something else.
Yeah.
It's weird that I'm forgiving of it because, I certainly liked that approach that RTD and that kind of that first 3-4 years of the show brought.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it is something... It's taking that familiar... idea. I mean, it's definitely, you know, I love the kind of the cubes and the idea of like, well, what would happen? And it's like, well, they would obviously be commercialized within an inch of their life, you know, and they'd end up as paperweights, they'd end up as a task on The Apprentice, they would, you know, and I love all that kind of stuff. It's that kind of attack on consumerism and sort of like sort of popular culture. It's just like, oh, you know, what are these? What are these? How can we sell them?
Which I don't understand how they believe there's any money to be made, because there's scenes that very obviously but there's scenes that take place like a couple of months after the cubes arrived, and they're still lying around places, like they're still like out in the park, or they're like lying and like in the hospital everywhere, and you think, how is anyone making money out of something you can? It's literally sitting like there. You know.
But then isn't that capitalism in general, though, isn't it? It's just like, how are you making money out of that thing that's like right there in front of me that I'm too lazy to make any money out of?
Well, so there's probably you can create little extended universe explanations in your head. It always reminded me, seeing the blocks, is you know, in the end of Time Part 2, where everyone is turned into the master.
Right.
I just always thought it was funny that like everybody is now the master, but as the episode goes on, and as like more hours since the conversion happened unfolds, like the masters are just sitting around in exactly the same place that the transformation happened. To the point there's a bit where they revisit the master that was standing at the dais thing delivering a speech as the president of the United States, and he's still behind that dais hours and hours and hours, that lectern hours and hours later. And so it reminded me of that. It's just where they've went, we need a lot of shots, we need to make sure that there's still a threat, so that they're still lying around, but that doesn't make any sense because they're on a business thing, and you know, that's So I get it, and I like it. But again, like, there's just something that you're weirdly willing to forgive about this episode.
Mm.
And I don't know if it's because what you get is Amy and Rory giving great performances, but they're not necessarily hampered by, you know, like the strident emotion that you get in a final episode. You get Matt Smith, who is, you know, like he's just living and breathing being that doctor.
Yeah.
And of course you get, you know, you get that real fan pleasure of seeing a Lethbridge Stewart and the return of UNIT and that kind of thing. Which I didn't know this until looking into it now, that Kate Lethbridge Stewart wasn't a creation specifically for the episode. She is an existing character that is on like the fringes of kind of those BBV, you know, those mid-90s made for video things where she's, you know, like she's part of the fiction before. You know, it would essentially be like, I don't know, like Bernice Summerfield showing up in the series, you know?
Yeah, that's... Because that was the thing, I never realised that until quite recently as well. It's like, oh, right, okay. That was an existing character that they've just gone... But it's like, yeah, so they must have just, that it must be deliberate. It's not just they've just like gone, oh, unless it's just one of those things that like Moffat in his head is just like, does the Brigadier, has it been established that the Brigadier's got a daughter called Kate? That, you know, like, yeah, that sometimes, like name, things will be in, yeah, the back of your head and you'll be like, oh, and then you'll look into it and be like, oh yeah, okay, fine, well, we'll stick with that.
Yeah, we'll just make it that character. Yeah. And that works out. Yeah.
Yeah.
So there's definitely something there on a number of levels, depending on, I don't know, like what era of fandom that you identify with. there's something there for everybody in it.
Yeah.
And actually, if we're looking at the ending, I do think that, and God knows what they cut out, if the ending was unusable, God knows what they cut out with Stephen Berkoff. But I think you're so kind of mesmerised by the way that he's attacking that role that it's not really until afterwards you go, hey, wait a minute, I have some questions here. Yeah. I have a few things I'd like to ask about this.
Yeah.
So it's weird that they got somebody like Stephen Berkoff, who has such a stage pedigree and has such an intensity as an actor, for them to give him on screen what looks like nothing. But then, the Ian McKellen was the voice of something.
Brian Cox,
Mitchell and Webb were the voice of something. Yeah, exactly. In the same episode, like Brian Cox, is it? So I thought it was part of the motif of this series, which is you get, you know, which would have, you know, made John Nathan Turner just gargle with pleasure. You know, you get like big names, and then you give them bugger all to do. I mean, this is the same, you know, producer that had Olivia Colman as just essentially a mouthpiece for a monster for like 20 seconds.
Academy Award winning Olivia Colman, yeah.
Even when she was cast, she was still very much in the door of being a national treasure then. So, you know, I just thought this was just a kind of part of the production motif, you know.
But he is weird, though, isn't he? Like, what?
Yes, he is.
What is he? The Tally! The Tally!
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's, he's... I think probably what has happened is that he said, yeah, I'll do a Doctor Who. Because one of the things I know about Stephen Berkoff, having studied drama at school, and then one of the things that we looked at was his play Messiah, which is a great play. Is that he regularly would take these kind of monetary jobs, these kind of, these mass market, broad appeal stuff, in order to fund the next phase of playwriting and play conception or whatever. You know, like he's in, is it Octopussy or something, the James Bond film? And so that paid for him out writing a play for a year. But I think he's probably just been told, all right, it's Doctor Who. And, like, he's just come with his conception of what a Doctor Who baddie was, which is, like, a scene-chewing monstrosity. And that's what he's delivered. This might not go in, but I just had a Google of Stephen Berkoff, and there's a thing about Reddit. This is somebody giving, like, a rundown of, like, defending Chibnall. This is presumably put up prior to him taking over. It's Power of Three is easily my favourite episode. The ending is rushed, but supposedly that is because the actor they cast as a villain refused to do what the script asked him to do, so Chibnall had to quickly rewrite the ending. That also explains why the episode only runs for about 40 minutes. I don't know if that's the case or not. Is it shorter? Right, so it sounds like he was basically a cunt.
Yeah. That's staying in.
Sounds like Berkoff was probably a cunt, wasn't he? It is interesting when you watch that. What is it called? Confidential light or whatever. Yeah. Those little things on the thing. The episode focuses on Chibnall being on set for these episodes.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay.
Standing by, presumably, for script writing and all that kind of, because Moffat's only in it as like presumably like a series long initial interview.
Yeah. Okay.
Like he's not present. Yeah. Like it seems like Chibnall's there overseeing some stuff. Yeah. So that's interesting.
That's funny.
That is. Yeah. Oh, and here's here's an absolute belter of a quote from Starburst magazine. Starburst magazine, they're doing an interview with Douglas McKinnon. And it said, "How much involvement did you have in casting actors Gemma Redgrave and Stephen Berkoff?" And he says, "I had the usual input with Gemma. Andy Pryor suggested her, and we all agreed quickly. Stephen Berkoff was slightly different in that I'd worked with him before." And this is the best bit. "The experience of working with him on Doctor Who was something that'll never be repeated. You could ask anyone on the cast and crew that they'll agree that his participation was extraordinary." Oh my God, what a diplomat that guy is. He's made it seem like, oh wow, it was such an extraordinary thing. What a cunt the guy was, definitely. Right, okay, that's, so there you are, listeners, like, reading between the lines. Berkoff was an arsehole. Oh, that's so funny. The experience of working with him on Doctor Who was something that'll never be repeated. Oh my God, right, okay, that's hilarious. Right, thank you for that, Starburst. There we are.
It is a Doctor Who story kind of like we've not seen before. As much as there's very familiar elements,
mm-hmm.
you know, we've got the kind of element of the Lodger,
yeah,
where, you know, the Doctor is kind of forced to live on Earth and, like, how he deals with that, which is not very well. We've got the kind of Russell T mixed media montage of kind of like how this alien threat or whatever it is affecting the rest of the world, to kind of give you a very economically dispensed bit of exposition as to how it's affecting the world around the characters. It's kind of a unit story as well, which obviously doesn't mean much to the younger viewers, but to a certain, like you say, a certain type of Doctor Who fan, there is a sort of frisson of nostalgia there. Like, yeah, it's all very modern, it's all very new, but it's still like the Doctor is kind of brought in to assist with a problem by the military. So there's all these elements, but actually, in terms of what it's about, it is that thing of like, well, actually, there's not really ever been a Doctor Who story told about the kind of effect on that, the conflict between traveling through time and space and living a normal life. And it's something that I think Stephen Moffat gets increasingly kind of distracted with as the series goes on. Because, I mean, I think most of Capaldi's series, I think you could easily cut out most of the Clara stuff, you know, like Clara being back home.
Yeah, but I think, from my point of view, is I like that take on it more, because there's an element of making it more real, whereas what you get here in this series is a lot of the result of stuff that happens off screen. You know, like the really, let's say the improbability of Amy and Rory going to have a divorce because they just can't get on. But you don't get to see that happen, apart from in like the lead up to it. They do those Pond Life little mini episodes that Chibnall also writes, and they're kind of weirdly cartoonish as opposed to,
well, because they're just little snatches, aren't they?
It's little snatches, and it's stuff like an Ood shows up and cooks them dinner for a bit, and you go, like, none of that seems especially trying. None of that seems like it's impacting on anybody's life particularly, or that they're anything other than going like, yeah, it's actually a laugh when we get away. But when you get to the Doctor and Clara, you do get a real sense of somebody being torn of the stakes that exist outside of the TARDIS. But I know what you mean. Like, I know what you mean. It's like,
the thing is, I think if you'd kind of taken out that divorce stuff, I think The Power of Three would have been a really great encapsulation of, because, you know, in Dinosaurs in the Spaceship, they're fucking changing the light bulb and the Doctor turns up and says, like, right, we're off to, you know, just this kind of, this idea of the Doctor offering escape from, like, the drudgery of your everyday life. It's like that friend of yours that's always just like, oh, do you want to go down the pub? When it's like, well, I do, but I've got to, like, you know, fill in a tax return, or I've got to, like, you know, contact my bloody gas and electric company, and you know, I've got to do all this like real world stuff. I can't really afford to like just drop it all and just go and have a laugh for the afternoon. And case in point, after a couple of days after I watched Power of Three, I spent my day hoovering the car, going to a car wash, hoovering the rest of the house, and then wandering around the furniture shop. And I was kind of just like, I'd fucking kill for somebody to just drop a police box on me right now and just be like, right, we're off.
Okay.
So yeah. I empathise.
Yes, okay, yeah.
And I think there is something in this, certainly. I think it's the best they do it, I think. Because actually, I think what the story is about, it's about, yes, the Doctor offers them an escape, but actually it's also about Amy and Rory going, kind of growing up and kind of realising that they can't keep running away from, you know, their adult life and their adult responsibilities, and that actually they're starting to enjoy being a married couple and enjoy having friends and jobs and all that kind of thing. So I think there's some really lovely elements to this that I think raise it above what could have been a very derivative Earth Under Siege story, you know.
Yeah, it's definitely not perfect, but I did enjoy it. I'm enjoying talking about it now. There's a lot to unpack with it, and a lot pleasantly to unpack. And I don't know. Like, I enjoyed it in a way that I didn't really get my teeth into Chris Chibnall's showrunner episodes. It's kind of weird because there's some really brilliant dialogue and some really great character interactions, and you know, and I don't know if there's maybe been a pass over it by Moffat or anything like that, but like, I don't think so. But interesting fact. So you know the very ending of the episode where the Doctor, Amy and Rory get inside the TARDIS, and kind of Brian's kind of weirdly wait, like Brian seems like he's there to see them off, but he's kind of like, don't go with him. Don't go with him, even though it's like, yeah, but mate, like a couple of episodes, you were off gallivanting around the galaxy with the Doctor, so what's your gripe about? But yeah, that was the very last thing that Arthur Darvill and Karen Gillan filmed for Doctor Who.
Oh, was it?
Then getting in the TARDIS at the end. And on the DVD, there's, you know, whatever, it's not Doctor Who confidential, but you know, like the wee 15-minute things that they've got, it's all centered around the last thing that they film on their last day, and it's the ending of that. So yeah, so I see what you mean. Like about the ending was obviously a rejig of something. If that was the last thing that was filmed for it, so
yeah, I think actually just talking about endings, I guess there's obviously a lot of portentousness about, you know, what's going to happen in the next story. You know, there's that kind of exchange between Doctor and Brian about, you know, the people that travel with you, you know, what happens to them. And it is playing with, you know, it's basically, it's like, look, you and I know this is Amy and Rory's penultimate story. You know, it's playing that kind of game with the audience, and it's kind of just like, oh, how are they going to go? Like, are they going to die, or are they going to just settle down and live happily ever after? And the answer, as we'll find out in the next story, is kind of both, I guess. But we'll come to that in the fullness of time. I do think that's quite, it's an interesting kind of, it's not a two-parter at all, but it feels a lot more kind of thematically linked, this and Angels Take Manhattan. That's not it, is it?
Yeah.
Is that it?
Well, the name of the episode.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's because there's a story called The Daleks. Oh no, it's Daleks in Manhattan.
Yeah, but you're thinking of the film The Muppets.
And I'm thinking of
Manhattan.
The Muppets Take Manhattan. That's what it is. I'm just going, well, am I just thinking of that Muppets film? But then that's clearly what gave them the name for it.
Yeah.
Just like, right, we take Muppets out and then put angels in.
Yeah, which is very dangerous from an inviting critique point of view, you know. But Charlie, what is your favourite scene and favourite performance?
It's mentioned by Gav, although I do like the scene between the Doctor and Brian at the party,
mm-hmm.
where the Doctor's like, not them, never them. I think it's really good. And also that scene with the Doctor and Amy on the banks of the Thames, I think it's really lovely.
Yeah, that's my one as well. I'll go all out to say it, I think it's one of the all-time great Doctor Who scenes.
Mm-hmm.
It's just really nice and understated. There's a good chemistry, and it's obviously two friends, i.e. actors, who are talking to each other,
yeah.
as well as the two characters.
Definitely.
Very beautifully shot. And it's great because it actually functions as a way of moving the story on as well. So it's it's a great scene. Performance-wise, I think definitely Brian, Mark Williams again.
Yeah, Mark Williams is great. So I think Gemma Redgrave's really good as Kate Stewart. I like her entrance, the kind of respect that she has for the Doctor, this kind of idea that she's finally kind of meeting this, in that way that I think a lot of Stephen Moffat characters do. It's that she's kind of meeting that, I guess, that character from the childhood stories that she's been told by her father. So there's that kind of nice element, but then also it's like she has a military mind and a professionalism that's just like, yeah, this guy's going to sort it all out and he's ahead of it. And I think it does kind of kick off like a kind of nice take on kind of modern day unit that isn't, because remember like when they first came back, when Russell T brought them back, and they were like, there's that episode of Torchwood where they're running like a Guantanamo Bay style facility.
Yeah.
And you're just like, nah, it's not.
Yeah.
Not unit. That's not, you know. So I like this. It's kind of, it shows a bit of promise that you kind of like, oh yeah, I hope they come back soon. And they do.
All right, should we take a break? You done?
Yes.
Should we take a break?
Yeah, I was going to say what I was drinking over the course of our discussion.
Sure.
I thought I'd have a little Duker's IPA, which is obviously made by the Caledonian Brewery in Edinburgh. Or as it's affectionately known in Edinburgh, the Cali!
All right, I wish you'd done it. I wish you'd been there.
Yeah, fucking. Look, when they do, when somehow it gets lost and they have to do the reconstruction of it, I'll play Berkoff.
Welcome back. Power of Three. We paired it with The Seeds of Doom. Unique for me, and I use that word with precision. That's a quote from it. That's a quote mark, isn't it? So it's a quote from the thing. Unique for me because this is new old Doctor Who for me. I've never seen The Seeds of Doom before. This is the first time seeing it. So this was a really strange experience. I didn't know what to expect, mm-hmm. but I kind of did. But then I don't know what I got back. That's what I'm going to enjoy about unpacking this with you.
Okay.
So yeah, this is formalities. The Seeds of Doom is by Robert Banks Stewart and directed by Douglas Camfield. This is Philip Hinchcliffe era. It was 6 episodes broadcast between the 31st of January and the 6th of March 1976. And ratings wise, it was broadcast to a fairly consistent 11 million viewers, the highest being episode 1, 11.6 million, the lowest being 9.9 million. But still, very well done to it. second go of the episode of the first 5 decades poll, Doctor Who Magazine, or as it's better known, just any opportunity to use this jingle. Degsy's Where Did It Come Game? Derek, Mark, where did the Seeds of Doom come?
So Derek says, the Seeds of Doom is fabulous. I'll let you dissect it, but what I can tell you is that John Challis is the only person who's replied to a letter from the Lugley Theatre Company. Have we talked about the Lugley Theatre Company on this before?
If we have, it's not been for a couple of years.
So the Lugley Theatre Company is a thing Derek does every couple of years, I think it is.
Yeah, it's fine.
Where he pretends to be the head of a theatre company in a sort of fictional Aberdonian town called Lugley. And he writes to various celebrities offering them the chance to play the role of Head Munchkin in their performance of The Wizard of Oz. There's various other jokes within the letter that I won't spoil in case Derek finally commits them to a book. So that's the context for that. So John Challis is the only person whose reply to a letter from the Lugley Theatre Company arrived in a tube. A handwritten letter and a photo of the cast of the green grass signed by him and Sue Holderness were inside. In terms of the Seeds of Doom, I think it must have done well in the poll, as when they did the multi-covers, I think mine was that story, although maybe that was the Mighty 200. Anyway, I'm going for number 6. I'm going to go a bit lower. I think it is probably, well, I think it was top 10 in the Mighty 200. But it might be lower now, but still obviously fairly... No, I'll stick, but I'm going to go with 9. Let's just flip Derek's number upside down.
It's actually 20.
Oh, is it?
It was in actual fact 16 for the Mighty 200 poll. But it's still the 8th best story of the 1970s, if you divide it by like that.
Stick that in the fucking Blu-ray cover, eh? The 8th best story of the 1970s. Oh, wow.
And there was loads of it. what have our dear listeners to say?
Jeff Waddle, similarly concise as the last time, or precise. He uses these words precisely. Great concept, brilliantly realised, villain brilliant, and so is the crinoid. Ooh, because the crinoid isn't really the villain, is he? Charles and Chase.
Is that it? Is it just...
J.R. Southall, The Seeds of Doom is nasty and illogical and somehow rather wonderful. I would agree with that. And over on Twitter, we have, of the New To Who podcast, if I can find him, Stephen B. From New To Who. A superb 2+4 Holmes High Gothic masterpiece with Amelia Ducat as Tom delights in calling her, and Harrison Chase stealing the show as the camp antidotal elements to its darker aspects. The Hinchcliffe target enthralled me, but cruelly removed Ducat. Hinchcliffe, where are you playing at? Also, is this Tom and Liz's finest hour as the Doctor and Companion? Well, we can discuss that, because obviously this is nearing the end of Liz Sladen's time as Sarah Jane Smith as well. And finally, I'm going to just say this every time he tweets us. The excellently named Jez Noir. An infinite number of Chibnalls typing on an infinite number of typewriters will never produce a Doctor Who script as entertaining as this. Although they'll probably come up with a joke from the final scene quite quickly. Damning! Damning!
So first up, I want to see a multi-Amelia story from Big Finish. I want Amelia Ducat and Amelia Rumford to get together and sadly, neither of the actors are with us anymore. A bit of spiritual recasting. I'd love to see that.
That'd be good,
because she is just fucking hilarious.
Yeah, she's great. Rutherford and Ducat investigating crimes related to plants and stones and that.
That's part of the title sequence. Rutherford and Ducat. It's pronounced Ducat.
Yeah, just somebody overblown, like Big Finish bit of music over the top of just like two old women pottering around the southeast of England.
Yeah, that was so fun. And then there's a weird time jump, because so Sarah grabs her in the corridor and says, "You need to go and tell such and such were trapped." And this is in the same space where down the stairs the Doctor's being loaded into that fertilizer.
Yeah.
And I think maybe did I look away or something like that, but then it cuts to, it's still within that same time period, and I'm presuming they want to get rid of the Doctor as quickly as possible, so he's not sitting in that fertilizer bin for like hours. But then it cuts to the two government ministers and her sitting in the car, which means, was she already in on this? Did she already know? Like,
yeah, that's the suggestion I got from watching it this time, is that there is a knowing, who's the actor that plays Emilia Dukakis again?
Sylvia Coleridge.
So Sylvia Coleridge, to me anyway, I don't know if this is how she's playing it in her head, but to me she's playing it with a real knowing quality. Like, she knows she's picked that exact time to turn up and ask for the money for the painting. Like, she knows something else is going on, and the fact that she seems to know everybody at the World Ecology Bureau as well. I'm like, is the suggestion here that she is working for them and she's kind of like undercover, well, not undercover because she is a painter, but you know what I mean? Like,
Well, because there's no way that she's like, this is what I'm talking about with like the weird flow of time between the two scenes. There's no way that she's gone back to her house, phoned them up, and then they pelted it out of London in a car. And then she's like, you know, like just been hanging around outside, because it's going to take a while for those for them to arrive. So it just seems to me like, yeah, she's undercover, like she knows what's going on.
Yeah, I've always definitely this time around watching it, that's what I took from it.
And then I thought the ending was going to be like that she knew how to defeat them. I mean, like, because the ending is kind of, it's not bog standard, it's actually, it looks really good, but it is just, there's a weird, there's a weird kind of bog standard of the quality of violence that's through the thing, ending with just you blow the thing up. So I thought, like, oh my god, are they setting her up at the end that, like, because she kind of equally lives and breathes and studies plants in the way that Chase does, that she's going to have, you know, the knowledge of how to defeat this thing, and it's just going to be like this little old Margaret Rutherford-esque kind of, you know, crafty old woman that saves the world. But yeah, you're right, she's just going to, like, disappears out of it.
Duckett and Rutherford, coming soon from Big Finish Productions. All will be explained. All will be explained.
Now, first up, I don't want to be negative. Like, I don't want to be negative about it. But hearing the kind of praise that it was getting sat a little uneasy with me. I didn't feel a connection to that way of thinking about it. I think because it... So firstly, it's acted brilliantly. Like, everybody is given terrific performances. The dialogue is amazing. Like, the dialogue is brilliant. There are some brilliant jokes. There are some brilliant moments. Each of the characters is so well defined. Douglas Camfield is a brilliant director. And I don't know why they made the choice of doing outside broadcasting rather than the standard doing it on film, but it just adds so much. Maybe because there was so much location stuff, they didn't want to, you know, obviously make it seem that there were so many changes between the style of how people were watching it. And I was certainly a massive fan of Terror of the Zygons, which is this team again. I just kind of weirdly think, though, that it's like the writing, so not the character, not the dialogue, but just the conception of the thing, the building it and putting it together, just seems there's a lot of padding. There's just a lot of padding and repetitive incident and you know, like a really making you aware of unlikely and improbable coincidence in order to get out of certain things, which I think... but then maybe it was wrong for the first time to have seen this be also the first time to analytically look at it, because what you're not fully allowing it to seep in and you fully enjoy it, though I did very much enjoy it. But I'm just kind of like, is it one of the best things Doctor Who's ever done? Is it, or does it just have elements of everybody doing their very best with something that was? Because I do also know as well, apparently there was a version, a non Sarah Leaving version of the Hand of Fear, which was supposed to have been the end of this series. That had some sort of production problem, so it was pushed to the next series, and this was commissioned hastily.
Because was that not going to kill off the Brigadier or something? Is it that?
Was it? Yeah, I think, was it supposed to?
There's some... I think so.
And what I do see in terms of the conception of this is it does feel very linearly put together, a story that's developing along with physically how it's being laid out, fleshed out. And I do kind of think that the story certainly improves when you move to Chase's house, because I actually really didn't like the first two episodes. Like, you know, because the Doctor and Sarah didn't really have a lot to deal with. There was the generic horror of the thing, but everybody was either a goodie or a baddie, you know, with that they were reacting against. And the best work comes in those last four episodes when there's suddenly a nuance to how people are approaching each of the subjects.
Well, because the thing is that it's all about paranoia. It's all about this thing that they're fighting can be any of the people in that room. And obviously, like you say, I quite like the first two parts of Seeds of Doom, but you are right in the sense that it removes that, because it is just Scorby and Keeler. They're obviously... Although Keeler's an interesting character, actually, even in those scenes. Although he's a bad guy, I think there's certainly a conflict in what he's doing and what he's being forced to do, which does make it interesting. But it is very much just a sort of battle for survival, and there's no kind of shades of grey. And then when they get to the house, you realise that Scorby's actually... he's in it for himself, and he's somebody who will just do what it takes to survive. And that then becomes an interesting... So then his loyalties will shift from Chase to the Doctor and Sarah, and then ultimately to himself, which is his undoing, I think is really, really interesting. And it's very rare, I think, you get that in Doctor Who. Like, supporting villain characters get such a trajectory in terms of their story.
Yeah, his last scene where he's talking about the past that he's had, being a mercenary in armed forces and armed areas. And then it's weird, because when he does make it through the door and then out through the attacking bushes, you do weirdly want him to survive.
You do.
And it is quite affecting when he falls into the water and then from beneath he's pulled down. It's, you know, so this is what I'm saying. There's just something for me lacking about, I don't know, the kind of conception of the thing, whereas so much of it then gets hidden by, like, the truly excellent values on other levels, you know. And it's almost weird. I don't know anything about the writing of it, but it does kind of seem like, as Robert Banks Stewart was sitting writing there, he was entertaining himself as much as, you know, like, it was, as I said, it feels like it was done very linearly, and that he's, like, entertaining himself with these characters as well.
This time around, I watched an episode a day for 6 days, and it was a really enjoyable way to do it, actually. And I think for me, I think I maybe escaped that kind of sense of padding and repetition. I think if you do watch it, because I think the first time I watched it, I did probably either watch it in kind of 2-3 part blocks, or the whole thing. I can't quite remember, but there is a lot of kind of running out of one room and then into, you know, once they're in Chase's house. Or, like, out into the grounds and then sort of running around there and then getting caught and then coming back, or then going back over to the World Ecology Bureau and then coming back over to the house again. There's a lot of that, which doesn't necessarily need to be in there.
There is a lot of, you know, for instance, the first time the Doctor and Sarah escape, the Doctor decides to climb on the roof, but then they capture Sarah. And it's just positioning your characters in a certain way. But there does seem a lot of, like, it seems improbably large, the house, and really badly guarded as
it's
well.
It's just got those two blokes.
Yeah, it's just those two blokes, Scorby, and then nobody else. So anybody could just go anywhere, you know. But these are all forgivable. Like, I mean, this is another nice dovetailing between the episode that we've previously discussed, is that everything about it, you can have like an unsteady foundation, but it's filled with so much good stuff. I don't think it's a masterpiece, but there were many, many times that when I was watching it, it just felt divorced from 70s television because it looked great. It looked, it felt contemporarily dramatic and comedic. It just was shot amazingly. And, you know, it is very definitely, like, when I come to give performances, I think Sarah Jane, Elizabeth Sladen, is a belter in this. Like, is absolutely great in this. Sit anybody down and make them watch this and be like, still keep on at me about this weird thing where, like, the Doctor Who companions are just there to look pretty and scream. And it's like, she's got, like, they are a proper, brilliant
And that's
partnership.
It, it's a partnership. It's, you know,
in this.
It's really great. I mean, I love the scene where she has to save the Doctor from the compost thing. And he's just like yelling, no, not that, not that switch, that switch. That's really fun, but also really unpleasant because you know he's about to be kind of ground down into mulch. And there's a really lovely, unpleasant undercurrent to this that never feels in that way that I think a lot of kind of, we've talked about this before, but a lot of kind of Colin Baker era, some of the Davison era, certainly the Sayward stuff feels, you know, where the nastiness kind of outweighs the charm and the wit, you know. I think this keeps it.
Yeah, yeah.
It really manages to balance the humour, the nastiness, the drama. It's just really well done, I think, in terms of the tone.
Yeah, yeah. The tone, more than anything. Everybody seems to be working perfectly towards that. There's just, like, I don't know, like, there's just so many, like, shopping list of brilliant things. Maybe this is what I'll do, rather than just kind of like a grand statements about stuff. Like, I'll do my favourite scenes now. I love the Cathedral of Plants scene where he's like doing, like, you know, Chase is like mixing an Aphex Twin album for the the plants. I love it's so Doctor Who. I love the moment where the Doctor's had a gun. He said, well, I have a pistol. And Sarah goes, but you won't use it. And they went, well, they don't know that. And then next scene, he walks into the room. Everybody's left by that point. But he goes, oh, all right, stick him up. Oh, I'm late to the party. That's, like, everybody's left the room. Like, that was perfect. I just, Tom. It's not the first time you see Tom Baker. It was the first time he's giving the report after they've come back from the Antarctic, where he's just moving a chair around the room and he's got it on his head. And he's still trying to talk with, like, authority about what's happening. There's just some, and, like, there's, as we said, Scorby at the end talking about what makes him tick is great. I think Keeler as a scientist trying to work out what it is he's trying to contribute to here. And then as he's converted, you know that scene where, like, where Sarah finds him, and it's kind of, there is a great performance there where it's like, it's half what's left of Keeler and half what's beginning to develop inside of him with a crinoid, trying to converse to save his own skin. I think is great. That scene where Dunbar is saying, give me half an hour and I'll try and sort this out, is really good. Emilia Ducat is great. Like, the only kind of weird weak kind of element to it is the unit edition, because there's obviously too little of it, and apparently because there was too little of it, that's why Nicholas Courtney and Sergeant Benton, John Levine, were not contacted to be part of it. But then that's also what I'm saying as well. Like, earlier when I mentioned a kind of weird bog-standard quality to the violence, it's like the Doctor is ready to pick up a gun. There is a bit where I thought the doctor like snapped a guy's neck. It's Scorby. I don't know he was going to be all the way in till the end. I thought he was like just a baddie. He was going to get his comeuppance. And there's a bit where the doctor like snaps his neck. And I'm like, fuck, what? This is worse than shooting any Ogron in Day of the Daleks. Yeah. Are you kidding? What has he done?
Yeah, but he's just done a kind of weird twist, like jujitsu twisty thing. And yeah, what's actually happens. But then there's
like the doctor like properly looks like he's enjoying punching out that chauffeur.
Yeah, the guy in the quarry. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a proper like wow.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like he takes. There's a bit of height to that punch, like before he knocks him out.
Yeah, because it's not like one of these kind of 1970s kind of just whapped on the back, like just a tiny tap on the back, and then it's up to the actor, and then it's up to the actor to like overreact and fall over. It's like it's a proper smackle. Now, I do think my threshold for violence in Doctor Who is higher than a lot of other commentators on this.
Sure.
But I think if it's done weirdly or creatively, I'm willing to overlook it a bit more than, you know, like than just the Doctor getting down and dirty with,
yeah,
in a way that, yeah. Well, what has he been watching, The Professionals or something? What's going on?
I think there's something in this about, I think, kind of like human nature and sort of humans as beings as animals, you know. That's sort of Harrison Chase's whole thing, isn't it? It's just like, you know, the real pure owners of planet Earth is the vegetation, and you know, and we're no better than the cows chewing the grass, sort of thing, you know. So I think, but actually in that, the Doctor's pitted against human beings, really, because the, you know, it's, you're kind of avoiding the crinoids and you're trying to figure out a way to stop the crinoids, but in his way or mercenaries and men with guns, and it's like, well, how do you deal with people like that? Sure, you can talk them around, or you know, if this guy's driven you a quarry with you and your friend to a quarry and is planning on killing you both, sometimes you just gotta punch a guy in the face and run away.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think it's dealt with all right. I think the next snap, well, not snap, but the neck twist, shall we say,
yeah,
is odd.
Yeah, it is, because they've obviously put the sound of a twisting neck on to the soundtrack. So, you know, so I don't know.
But, you know, and him crashing through the ceiling and kind of, that's fine as well. That's
oh, yeah, cool. That scene where he just batters everybody. Like, he comes through this, and then, like, Chase goes, and what are you going to do for your encore, Doctor?
Yeah.
It's like he's, like, battering people with chairs, punching folks out. I was like, wow, okay.
It's because he wants to save his friend. And you know, this is the only language. It's the only language these people understand, Ben. You know, the old fisticuffs.
Yeah, but I don't think I've ever seen that doctor, be so, like an obvious kind of like street tough. You know.
Yeah, true. I'll give you that.
And generally be quite annoyed with everybody.
Yeah, he is quite bullshit, isn't he?
Yeah, when, like, he gets like episode 5 and 6, when he's like trying to, now, okay, obviously he knows like the scale of the problem.
Yeah.
But you know, like the kind of guttural annoyance that he treats everybody with really is no different to what people seem to criticize Peter Capaldi.
Yeah.
About,
or
you know,
John Pertwee as well. You
yeah.
But I kind of like that. I kind of like a grumpy Fourth Doctor, you know, like I like the wackiness and I like that, but I do quite like, I think the best thing about Tom Baker's Doctor is the turn on the coin that, you know,
yeah,
he can be really, you know, confrontational and shouty, and you know, I love him just yelling waffle into that unit general's face.
Yeah,
it's great because he has no respect for authority. That's the Doctor, you know.
Yeah. What do you think? I've just waffled about I
waffle!
Think of it.
Waffle. I really like it. I think it feels different but familiar. I think there's something to be said for that, in the way that, I guess, the Power of Three was, you know, different but familiar. In terms of the violence, in terms of the threat, as well, it's one of those stories where, you know, the crinoid can destroy the whole planet by itself. That's its kind of very nature, as it were. But I think there is something interesting in Harrison Chase and what he wants to achieve with that. I think is something. It's something really good, and I think, you know, there is a thing. I think we've talked about it with Davros and the Daleks, and that was maybe always taken the wrong way. But, you know, that kind of mouthpiece for the monsters, you know, and I think Harrison Chase is fantastic. You know, those black gloves, that cold, that sort of deadpan delivery as well of the kind of bon mots, like, you know, the kind of what do you do for your encore, Doctor? It's just that he just doesn't give anything away. He's just very kind of like buttoned up. He's a really great Doctor Who villain.
Yeah, he is.
And he gets a really properly nasty ending as well. You know, and I love that scene. It's like, you know, it's he kind of goes into the compost and the Doctor says, I tried to pull him out, but he kept trying to pull me in. And Sarah's like, I know. That's great. That's really great. Because it's not, because for all the punching he does and smashing chairs over people's heads and all that kind of thing, that I think kind of shows that he's still very much the Doctor, and if he can help it, no one's gonna die. You know, they might get a fat lip, but, you know,
yeah,
that, you know, if he can save everybody, he's gonna try and save everybody, no matter what they've done. I think that's just a really lovely little moment. So yeah, I really love it, and there is a kind of, obviously, what is it, Mask of Mandragora, then Hand of Fear after this. Is that right?
Yes, it is, yeah. I think so. Is it?
Because
yeah.
This is the end of that series, isn't it? Because the Hinchcliffe years always ended with a six-parter. Pretty much, apart from, obviously, Terror of the Zygons. But, no, because that opened the series. Apart from Revenge of the Cybermen, I should say. But there's no sense to me that... And I think you get that when sort of interviews with Tom Baker, where he's, you know, talks about how surprised he was when Liz Sladen decided to leave. Because you don't get the sense of what she was worried about, which is that, you know, Hinchcliffe maybe wanted to bring in his own creation. You don't get that, because it's not as if the script isn't giving her interesting stuff to do in the story. Where, you know, you sometimes find that with people who inherit characters and haven't been there at the genesis of that character. They're not quite sure how to handle them, and then they don't get some good material. Whereas you never get that with Sarah Jane. Like, I think, you know, and certainly not in this story. I think, you know, she's dealt really well. And her relationship with the Doctor is brilliant. They're so much fun together. And they care about each other. And it's so refreshing sometimes, you know, to watch the Doctor and a companion, and they get on with each other. And you can feel that they get on with each other. It is quite sad that we've only got another two stories with Liz Sladen after this. Obviously, until she comes back and does amazing things by herself. But it feels like those two could just go on forever.
Yes, it's a great partnership. You know, and I guess, like I said, with that scene in Power of Three, where the Doctor and Amy are looking over the Thames, a lot of it feels like people who, actors who are utterly comfortable with each other, as well as, you know, just people who know how to turn on the old charisma and chemistry. They are rightly celebrated as let's face it, I mean, like, they probably are. They probably are the image of when people think of Doctor and Companion. Yeah. Even now, there's been, 14 years of New Who.
I know, Christ. I mean, you can't really call it New Who anymore, can you? It's just like, it's just 14 years of Doctor.
Yeah. But when you think of the Doctor, you think of the scarf, you think of Tom Baker, and you think of Sarah Jane as the companion.
Yeah, so I really enjoy watching this again. As I always enjoy, I mean, I just enjoy that period. There is just something, and I know I'm not fucking breaking new ground here by saying, you know, 1970s Doctor Who was fantastic. You know, early to mid-70s Doctor Who. But it's really great. And I think, you know, yes, it's definitely got... Seeds of Doom definitely has its flaws. there is a lot of kind of running out of rooms and back into rooms and running around grounds and all that kind of and driving here to be driven back there. But actually, when it's got a cast as brilliant as this and characters as, you know, diverse, well, not diverse, I guess, but in terms of backstory and in terms of character, there's like, they all feel like human beings, which is something, you know, rare for, you know, even this kind of golden age of Doctor Who. I think there's very often just like a bunch of people, even the guys on the base, you know, who only get two episodes, they feel like, you know, proper characters.
I mean, yeah, you feel like you've encountered snapshots of real life. It's I don't know, it's really good.
You've already done your favorite scenes. My favorite, one of my favorite performances is Mark Jones as Keeler. I think he's great. There's like loads of little lovely little bits that he does, like when him and Scorby have got everybody tied up in the base. I think he's like going round behind the Doctor and Sarah to like tighten the knot or something like that. And he just goes, excuse me. Just out of politeness, he just asks, excuse me, let me just tighten that knot around your wrist. It's really funny because it is just this guy, he's like a man of science that's forced into this sort of aggressive position and just can't really handle it, and he's such an interesting character. So I think he's, but because, you know, obviously John Challis is excellent, Sylvia Coleridge is excellent, who else? Tony Beckley, of course, you know, as Harrison Chase is terrific.
Yeah.
And favourite scenes? Yeah, I mean, there's so many. Is it TV centre, by the way, actually? I was going to ask. You know, the World Ecology Bureau? Is that television centre?
Oh,
I don't know, it's just when they come out... When they come out and get into the car, it just felt like all that kind of footage from, like, you know, the Morecambe and Wise show and the two Ronnies, when, like, they're just wandering around outside TV Centre. It felt like that, but I don't know if it actually was. I feel like I need to... Yeah, so location filming at BBC TV Centre. So it was outside there.
Heading into the BBC bar.
Heading out of the BBC bar. And, you know, unsensibly for the 1970s, having a designated driver, even if that designated driver is out to kill you, and maybe you would have just been safer drink driving.
So that was good. I enjoyed both these.
Good. So I've been drinking. I should point out, if you heard the ice chinking against the glass during that recording, I've been drinking a Seedlip, Seedlip, which is a non-alcoholic gin. It's fucking pointing out.
Well, thank you for joining us, everybody. Episode 71. Episode 72, it's The Muppets. The Angels Take Manhattan. But what are we pairing that up with? This is our first discussion.
That's a bloody good question. I was thinking today, I had two stories in mind. One of which, partly because I've now got it on Blu-ray, and then partly... because it's about like a companion departing, a kind of well-loved companion, choosing to live in a different dimension.
Okay.
So it's like Warrior's Gate, I thought, because there's a bit of time stuff going on in that, isn't there?
Yes.
Is that right? There's like two time zones and there's like a different universe, obviously because they're in e-space and all that kind of thing. So that was one story I thought of. And the other one was the Space Museum, because again... It's about kind of events and then kind of going back in time and...
Space Museum. Oh my God, I don't know, because I actually can't be fucked with either of them. but we get it, you've...
What's your bloody suggestions then? What's your bloody suggestions?
I hadn't really... I don't know, I should have thought of that. We can talk about it after. Well, should we say Warrior's Gate then? Because, I mean, Warrior's Gate...
We don't have to do Warrior's Gate.
No, but I was thinking along the lines of, where are we looking at the companions that leave? Have we done Earthshock?
Yeah. We have done Earthshock.
So what else? Or should we do like something like The War Machines? You know, and go completely the opposite way. you know, how you do get rid of a companion and how you don't get rid of a companion.
No, because I think, I like that idea, but the War Machines, I think we'd always said would be quite good for Bells of St. John.
Yeah, which is coming up anyway, so that's, you know, it's coming up in two episodes' time, isn't it? So, okay. And we've done the chase, so we've seen Ian and Barbara
we've done Dalek Invasion of Earth, we've done the War Games, we've done the Green Death.
You know, do we want to do, like, the Savages, see Peter Purvis's departure, or...?
Well, we won't see it, we'll hear it.
well, yeah, exactly. We could do the Invasion of Time, you know, there's another companion that departs because of love.
Yeah. Well, that's not a bad idea.
Yeah, maybe the Invasion. The Invasion of Time.
Although then we could also do the Invasion of Time later on in the series with Journey to the Centre of the TARDIS.
Yes, that's maybe the better place for that to be, isn't it? Yeah.
Oh, man, it's tough.
Let's go for Warrior's Gate. Yeah.
All right.
Something a bit high concept, a bit weird. Sees a companion go, hopefully with a bit of emotional heft to it.
Yeah. Now in glorious high definition.
I'll just be sticking on the usual old eSpace DVD box set.
Nice. I remember being really excited to get the eSpace Trilogy box set on VHS for Christmas. Because I'd got my Christmas... Because obviously, like, my birthday's Christmas Eve. I got my birthday money. And we had to go into town or something like on Christmas Eve to get some last minute present or something for a family member. I just say, "Oh, mum, can we go to John Menzies? I want to buy the eSpace trilogy with my birthday money." And she's like, "No, I wouldn't. I wouldn't do that if I was you. No, we won't have time. We won't have time." And then the next day, obviously, it was unwrapped. It
is that John Menzies? Was that the video box?
Yeah, it was the video box. Yeah. And I remember not being that excited by the time I actually got around to watching it.
Yeah.
But maybe that will change. I'm going to continue to do season 18 so that by the time I hit Warrior's Gate, I'll have the context of the rest of the series around it as well. Whether or not that yields any further insights on other than the usual on the time lash, it was all right.
Yeah.
Because that's what you tune in for. That's okay. What you tune in
well,
for.
Well, 2 weeks, maybe I'll see if I can do that, do the context with you. We'll see. But thank you for joining us. As always, Facebook, Twitter. We would love to. And do you know what? Genuinely, we do love to hear your thoughts. There's a nice little pool of commentators.
Yeah, definitely. So thank you to them, and thank you to you, person who sits at home listening to this and goes, maybe this episode will be the episode where I tweet my thoughts. Come along, tweet your thoughts.
Yeah, let's hear from you, cheeky sausage.
And give us a review on iTunes as well. Give us a review on iTunes, because those help. And we've got some nice ones on there as well, so that weren't written by us. So,
Well, thank you. I've been Ben, and I am Ben.
I've been and will continue to be Mark. And he's Kef McCulloch.